I have finally won the battle. We will pay the dog walker for this month, but no more months.
There you go. Zero. You got it down to zero, huh? that's pretty impressive, man. I thought you'd come back. Well, here, we're gonna pay half, like 100.
I thought that's where it was gonna go.
Well, was it a battle, or was she kind of like, yeah, you're
no,
right?
No, I think you got to stake out your position, and then at a certain point, it's like a finger trap where the harder you struggle, the worse it is. You just kind of have to stake out your position. You understand the other position, and then inevitably something happens that might make them come to your side of it. You know, maybe you want a couch. Maybe you want this. Maybe you want that.
Oh, wow. You start dangling material incentives, huh? Oh, jeez, Ethan.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying I did it.
Smarmy negotiation tactics in the home, huh?
Well, Jade, I don't know if I want you to include this because
not listening.
No, it's not that. I'm worried about the dog walker. Like, what if the dog walker
listens to the pod?
No, he's an NPR listener. The only time he ever indicated any knowledge of anything I do is when I did an NPR interview, and then he mentioned that he heard that was on the radio.
And if the dog walker is listening, like, look, $300 a month per family to walk a dog, bro, I would be quiet if I were you. I wouldn't raise too much attention.
I think it was 270, but yeah, it's hey, Allie loves that dog, man. I love the dog too, but do you really think
if I showed up to walk Otto, the first day he'd be combative. The second day he might resist. By day three, I give him some treats. We're out for a walk.
It wouldn't even take that long.
He doesn't know Allie, and I'm black, so it would take a little bit longer. But the point is, he does.
There was an uncomfortable period where we moved from our apartment on Harrison Street to a new place when Otto was younger. And the movers were black. And I swear it made Otto racist for at least a year. I swear. Like, that was his experience. These dudes showed up. Little does he know that they're here to help us out, you know, but from his perspective, these dudes showed up and forced him out of the only home he'd ever known. And it just made him a miserable racist for a while until he forgot about it.
Yeah, I hear the same thing happened to David Duke.
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Stars hang with stars. Winners hang with winners.
I am this many days old when I found out that, Ethan, this is the third home you've lived in with your now wife.
Well, I think we've lived, I mean, not home. We've only lived in one home. But
home is home. It's where you rest your head and take a shower.
Well, there's the basement apartment, Harrison Street, Baker Law. So this is the fourth. This place is the fourth. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow, man.
We used to move every year. Like we were on the run.
I just the idea that you lived that long together, like living together.
Well, I would recommend, there's a lot of trepidation about living with people really early into the relationship. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for something long term in general, I think it's good to set the pattern early. I think it's good start.
I've always said this because culturally for me, where I'm from, like the idea of living with a significant other is unheard of and very much frowned upon until you're married. And I've always like at first I was like, yeah, no, I could never live. And I still like have that stigma. I could never live with someone I'm dating.
You're talking about Star Wars fan culture, right? That's what you're referring to. Exactly.
but the reality is, the smart thing is once you start dating someone and you mutually are looking at each other like, yo, this could be it. This could be the one. Then it would behoove you move in together because much like the whole NBA teammates, like superstar teammates, let's play together thing. Like, it's one thing when you hang out with your buddy in the off season and during All-Star weekend and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And on Team USA, it's another thing when you see them every single day, because then you see all the little idiosyncrasies that really drive you insane. Like, you know, chewing with their mouth open, like watching TV with subtitles on, you know, you name it. Like, there's these little things that you might say, oh, that's not like, what? That's not going to get in the way of the marriage. But like 8 months in, you're going to be like, Jesus Christ. Like,
yeah, you're going to have to relearn a bunch of habits. I would make the analogy where the issue with college basketball for the NBA, a lot of it's
segue.
That
you segue, motherfucker. You.
They get so used to certain rules. I mean, the rules aren't the same. They're not the same. The three-point line isn't the same. The shot clock isn't the same. And these are all things that you're going to have to relearn when you get to the NBA versus the situation.
Mm-hmm. The paying people in a duffel bag rather than just like a W-2 isn't the same.
It's not the same. You know, you gotta launder. I mean, you're developing all these skills that frankly you won't need. It's almost like when you have to break your arm to regrow it properly. I just think it's good if you think you got a good thing going. Yes, living with one another is messy. Yes, a breakup would be ugly and bad, but it's not that big a risk compared to actually getting married.
Get married, yeah, man.
You know?
You live together, you test drive it, it doesn't work. You return it to the lot. You say, hey, not for me. And then you keep moving. And yeah. I didn't use gender in that statement, so that can't be misogynist in any way. Maybe it's the woman that returned the guy back to the lot. Who's to say? Maybe it's a woman returning another woman. Look.
It could be anything.
It could be anything.
It could be anything. I don't know. Is a car – I mean, a boat is always a woman. I don't know who made up that rule.
A boat's a boat unless – but the mystery box could be anything. It could be a boat.
Nice reference. But yeah, I don't know of a car. I don't know if a car is a woman. Boat, they always say she set sail. You know, we decided that boats and hurricanes are women. That's just what we decided. I don't know why we decided it. Well,
boats
wait.
And hoes.
No, wait a second. I think hurricanes can be like Andrew. Anyway, let's start
Andrew,
the show.
Yeah.
Welcome to the House of Strauss. We are joined by favorite guest, the one that the listeners love the most, broadcaster extraordinaire, Amin El Hassan on the horn. We have watched not just obviously The Last Dance, which the entire world has watched. Freudian slip, as I was about to say lost, because the thing we did watch came out about, I think, a month ago, and it was pandemic season, everybody losing their mind. I feel like it went completely under the radar. The Scheme on HBO.
Good afternoon. Let me be very, very clear. I have never discussed with Christian Dawkins paying DeAndre Ayton to attend the University of Arizona. In fact, I never even met or spoke to Christian Dawkins until after DeAndre publicly announced that he was coming to our school. Any reporting to the contrary is inaccurate, false, and defamatory.
I'm very proud of everything I've done as LSU's head coach, and I'm very proud of what we've done at LSU. And we have never, ever done business of any kind with Christian Dawkins.
About the wild world of college basketball secret payments and the FBI scheme to uncover it that really just accomplished nothing at all except wasting our tax money and everybody's time in this crazy undercover sting. But it was a fascinating story.
By the way, you guys didn't see it because it's a podcast, but Ethan used air quotes wrong, secret payments.
Yes. Well,
if you're listening to this and you're like, they're paying them, then this may not be the podcast
for goods and services. Well, there is something a little weird to me about. Okay, so I don't think we're going to get into the nitty gritty of this documentary because not everybody will have seen it. And so I was thinking about how do I talk about it in a way that would make sense and be interesting for somebody who hasn't seen it. So I think one way is to talk about the business model, and the other way is to talk about what you're saying, which is I was a little oddly scandalized watching this documentary, even knowing what I know, just hearing Sean Miller, the coach of Arizona, just over the phone orchestrating these payments to players. and knowing that it just really resulted in nothing whatsoever, and he's just still the coach of Arizona and nobody cares. That was a little shocking to me. That was just a little teensy bit shocking to me. What say you?
For me, the shock, like, obviously I knew all of this stuff. Like, this is how the sausage gets made, right? The shocking thing for me was, and if you're listening to this and you say, hey, I read all the Yahoo stories and the news stories and the coverage throughout, I'm up to date. I think you'll be shocked if you watch this documentary, because for me, I read all that stuff, and at the time I was suspicious. I know Jim Gatto. And so I was like, yo,
can you explain who Jim Gatto is?
Jim Gatto was an Adidas employee who was kind of a middleman in many of these transactions. And, you know, my thing is, like, if you're bringing a federal case, you can't puff your chest out and say, we got Jim Gatto, right? Like, he's not a criminal mastermind, and he's not and he doesn't love Adidas so much that he would go above and beyond what they've asked him, or the purview of his duties, to ensure that these players become Adidas athletes. Like, this is how business gets done in this world.
I'm just watching. Like, tell me what you know about James Harden. No, I'll never talk.
Right. No, I like the idea of the president of Adidas, like, Jim did what? Like, no, that's not how this works at all on any level. And so for me, when the news first broke, when the FBI had that big press conference, right, announcing that they were going to shake up college basketball, I was like, here we go.
Yeah.
They're actually going after people, big name head coaches, university presidents, maybe Mark Emmerich, head of the NCAA. Like, real deal, like, we're going to round up these people and put a scare into the world of college athletics, which we know is an extremely exploitative landscape. And instead, watching this documentary, it becomes very evident that they are there to basically just, what's the thing from The Wire? Drugs on the table?
Yeah, drugs on the table.
Make some noise and have a photo press.
I was going to say Rick Pitino on the table, but then I forgot that's a double entendre. But yeah. You continue.
Yeah, so it's like, it was just so disappointing. The documentary is not disappointing. The documentary is illuminating. But, like, what that investigation ultimately amounted to was so disappointing. Not disappointing like, oh, you guys didn't get the big fish, but disappointing that not only did you not get the big fish, but in order to save fish, you targeted mere pawns in the game.
Yeah.
Just pawns. And that really,
and probably good dudes overall.
I can speak on Gatto. Gatto's a great dude. You've never met someone who doesn't like Jim, right? And the idea that this dude has to have lawyers to prevent him from doing federal prison time is just, like, you talk about a waste of money, right? When we have real life criminals in this country exploiting people, murder, drug trafficking, all of these things, you're going to pick on this dude? The same, I would imagine, goes for everyone else. Even if some of these guys were jerks.
Yeah.
Being a jerk is not cause enough to be the subject of a federal investigation resulting in federal penitentiary time. It's just insane. Even Christian Dawkins, who
He's the protagonist of the documentary, yeah, to be clear. Kind of a runner, if you will, a very skilled runner coming out of Saginaw, Michigan. Played on that Draymond Green team, I think, early on, but realized he wasn't that level of good, and decided to do this. He becomes the center and the focus of the entire weight of the federal government as they are investigating this. But yes, you were saying.
And so, like, Christian Dawkins, I found him to be a very, like, interesting character. He likes to paint himself like, I'm just a good dude. There's some of the stuff they're like, really, dude? But at the end of the day, he is by no means a threat to anyone. He's not a menacing dude. He's not a, play outside the lines in that way of, like, incorporating that kind. And so the story of how he got arrested was just the most shameful, shameful, like, use of taxpayer funds and resources.
It's insane.
Not to mention, let's just call it what it is, super racist. super racist.
The idea that they popped out with the guns and everything is just completely insane. You'll get a better sense of it too if you watch the documentary and see that this guy is not like a threat. You know, at most there might be some financial shenanigans, but it's just the level of really, I'd say, cruelty. I mean, I came away from it actually a little bit concerned. You know, this is one of those things where this is what we know about happens, comes to the surface of the FBI misusing its power in this way. I mean, good God, what's happening that we don't know about was something that I took away.
Right. Right. And by the way, that takes us to another place, which is the rampant corruption and fraud that was happening within the FBI, where you have one of the agents on the case who embezzling federal money that was used to kind of lure these people to basically go out and have a good time on his own dime. Yeah. And rather than that being addressed or this whole investigation really being thrown out, they just kind of reassigned the dude and moved on.
Yeah. Well, they got pot committed. So to explain to the listeners who have not seen it, the FBI is investigating this. They have this big they say, "We got your playbook," to all of college basketball. God. College basketball shaking in its boots. Because they're doing it in the Southern District of New York. This is the big this is where it goes down. You know,
this is where Gotti got.
Yeah. So this it's going down. Like they're all gonna fall. They're all gonna fall. It's all gonna happen. And I have a theory about what really happened, but what it appears to have happened, as they would explain it maybe, is that they didn't get what they wanted to get. Christian Dawkins didn't roll over and reveal all his connections to these shady college coaches operating outside the bounds of the law. And so they just kind of had to shrug and try to make life tough for the Gattos of this world and the Christian Dawkins of this world. I don't know if that's the case, because you do hear Sean Miller and other major college coaches orchestrating payments that at the very least, even if it's not just breaking NCAA rules, typically you cannot pay people sums of money that are vast off the books without giving Uncle Sam a taste. So
sure.
I wonder if somebody powerful put in a call to somebody else powerful and they went, maybe this isn't what the Southern District should be doing. I got a lot of friends here in the college basketball scene. It just seems like maybe it was scuttled for reasons beyond having a dearth of information.
So scuttle it. My thing is, so scuttle it.
Yeah, scuttle it. Don't keep pressing on.
You can't.
Yeah.
And even if you get these people and you know, you want to like hit some people with some misdemeanors, which still stinks and still isn't right that these guys should have a quote unquote record. But you were trying to put these people in prison, man. Mm-hmm. Like what kind of monster just throws people in prison at a whim? It's incredibly, incredibly disappointing. Let me see. Hold on, by the way. Let me see if I can find my notes on this thing. Because scheme. There we go.
Maybe it was just a big Arizona State fan behind the whole thing.
By the way, here's one of the great quotes from this. I think the documentary starts with this quote.
Will Wade's driving the price of pussy right now? Is that the quote?
No, nine out of 10 schools cheat. The 10th is in last place.
Oh, Jerry Tarkanian's got the best quotes on that stuff, man. I love that one, and I love the NCAA is so mad at Kentucky, they're going to slap another 2 years on Cleveland State. That's the other Tarkanian quote I love.
The quote by Christian Dawkins at the end where they're like giving him a hard time about like cheating, so like I invented that shit. I'm if you're a listener, I don't know if you're like kind of skeptical, not my college. Let me tell you something. UCLA, yes, that one with John Wooden and the Wizard of Westwood, and it's a great academic institution and thoughtful players like Kareem and Bill Walton and like really intelligent guys. Yes, they cheated. They had a guy named Sam Gilbert.
All you need to really know without knowing the basics and the particulars is that Under Armour has a contract with UCLA. Now, if I said to somebody, hey, off the street, what do you think that costs to just get that Under Armour insignia on the shirts and on the shoes of the basketball team and the football team and whatnot.
What do you think
that is? I wonder what the person off the street might think that entire contract is. Maybe they think it's $1 million. I mean, we're just talking about, I don't know, the logos and all that. You know, maybe it's $280 million. It's a $280 million contract.
Well, I guess my thing is, people, like, it's a lot easier to understand modern day cheating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm telling you that John Wooden was getting players because they had a booster named Sam Gilbert who was paying people. This isn't a 21st century phenomenon.
Yeah.
This is something that was happening in the 60s and the 70s, as far back as the 60s and 70s, maybe even further back than that.
Oh, because back then you could get away with anything too. I mean, that's the thing. You
could get away with some people. Remember, Connie Hawkins was the center of a massive kind of scandal in college basketball because they accused him of point shaving when really what it was he was getting paid. And, you know, he became a pariah and all that stuff. So this is something this is as old as the peach basket, probably.
Yeah.
It happens. Well,
yeah. Of course people are going to get paid money. It was so fascinating to hear the way it's done though. It's not me saying this is a quote from Christian Dawkins on the phone. Will Wade is driving the price of pussy right now. Will Wade, this guy, he looks like a missionary. He looks like a stereotype of a clean cut, just out of Pleasantville. And he just seems to be the most rule breakingest of the modern college coaches. I think he's 37. For those who don't know, he's the coach of LSU. All of a sudden, LSU has gotten prospects and gotten good out of nowhere. And the way that Dawkins is talking about him, it just sounds like he's almost like a Knicks. He's like a Knicks GM from back in the day, where it was funny to me because I was thinking, we don't think about these coaches as GMs in college basketball, because in theory, they're just recruiting. That's all they're doing. But they're really allocating resources. And are they signing the best contracts sometimes when they get some of these guys? Was Will Wade really paying, you know, was he making smart money ball decisions with his money, or was he not? These are questions that we never ask that are completely relevant to how these programs are performing.
That's why when people talk about who are the best coaches in a sport, we inevitably almost never mention college coaches, because not a whole lot of that is coaching. All that other stuff, going to people's houses and sitting in living rooms and having a weekly radio show and making the boosters happy and making sure kids are passing their classes and paying people, like, that's not coaching. Coaching is the stuff that happens and you draw it up on a grease board or whatever. And that's why the best coaches of all time all prove their mettle in the NBA. And that's why the vast majority of coaches in college who try to make that shift to the NBA fail miserably.
Yeah. It's a GM job that we don't acknowledge, because we cannot just acknowledge what's actually happening, which, I mean, when you actually watch this too, you'll get a sense of this is so widespread. I mean, this is how these guys talk. This is how these guys talk when nobody's around. They're really talking about how much to pay these guys to get whatever teenagers they think can help their program on board. And it's a whole infrastructure. And it's funny to me that all this happened and it didn't result in the big federal case. And then we just kind of kept it all moving. I mean, it's all stopped now with the pandemic, but it's funny to me that we're just going to, I suppose, pretend that it's not going on. I mean, the NCAA recently said you can actually make money off your likeness. I feel right now the NCAA is noticing that the NBA, my theory from what I can observe is that it's starting from Australia, that Australia said, come over here, we'll pay you a nice six-figure income, young prospects, to play in Australia. So they got some buzz and they got people watching LaMelo and RJ Hampton. And then the NBA is looking at that and going, well, we can't let the NBL just make money in a way we could. So then they set up their G League pathway. And then now you've got the NCAA looking at the situation and going, uh-oh, you know,
I'm going to push back a little bit. I won't say it was. First of all, the NBA plan to increase.
I'm sure all this stuff had like a precursor.
Beyond, right. The NBA plan to increase compensation for the G League had been something in the works for a while. Right. So you start there before, you know, Australia that, remember, Terrence Ferguson was the initial Australian test case, right? So then Australia, the NBL starts making headway in that space. But I don't think college would have reacted to that. I think the G League, what they did, you know, last month, basically announcing this, that's what put the fire under colleges. Because it's one thing to say, yeah, sure, go live in a foreign country where the coach may not even play you and your friends and family are so far away and you got to wake up in the middle of the night just to talk to them. And like, you can skip for what? For 150 grand or 200 grand? What good is that going to do?
Like, inserting into Count Dracula.
Right. But when it's like, no, like no NBA scout is going to, or scouts can't see you easily. And there's a bunch of kind of pushback you can give, and you're going to lose a couple here and there, but that's what it is. When you have a program that's right here, it's in Southern California, right? It ain't the middle of nowhere. It never rains in Southern California, right? It doesn't snow in Southern California. You come out here, and not only are we guaranteeing you, you're going to get your college education because you got a full ride scholarship to the institution of your liking, of your choosing. Okay, boom. There goes that argument that the NCAA has. Two, we're going to pay you handsomely, right? We're 300 grand, 400 grand, 500 grand to Jalen Green, the number one player in the country. And of course, he can go pursue off the court earnings, which Goodwin Sports fully intends on doing for him. Okay, so the compensation package is out of this world. All right, and then it's like, you're going to spend your whole life either training with NBA caliber coaches against semi NBA caliber competition, learning what it takes to be an NBA player on the court, but not only that, off the court. We're educating you on what it's like to be an NBA player, how to say, like, the life skills you need, not calculus, not, English lit 101, not creative writing, but things that you're actually going to come in handy immediately as you navigate this world, right? They're going to teach you all those things. You're not going to play a 30-game schedule. Oh, you're going to be embarrassed because the G League's already – yes, they're only playing about 12 to 15 games. Most of this stuff is going to be towards development, and the games only exist as testing grounds to apply things learned in a controlled environment. So what you're talking about is coaches who are going to coach you to be the best you could possibly be, not because I'm trying to win a G League championship, not because I'm trying to keep my job. And so all of these things, if you're a kid – and by the way, last but not least, this isn't a free-for-all. The G League is going to identify who are good candidates for this program while it has something to do with you being an elite prospect basketball-wise, it's not entirely based on that. And so if I'm a kid and I'm listening to all of this, and all college can do – and please forgive me for being blunt here.
The Rick Foxy game?
All they can do is give you the Rick Foxy and he got game. Like, that's not
I'll leave you three alone is what you're saying?
Yeah, like, that's not as compelling an argument, right? Like, if I got to sneak around to get paid, and I got to go to a bunch of classes that I really don't care about, or at least not at this point. And by the way, if anything goes wrong, you guys are going to pull my scholarship and basically, you know, you can basically turn your back on me. Like, all these things, all these strings that are attached to whatever bag of money those kids get to go to school, like, we've done away with all of them.
I mean, I don't know. It seems like, James Wiseman's experience as the top prospect going in with the NCAA would just have these other prospects chomping at the bit to go down this road. I don't see what the issue is. But
it's crazy. I mean, but it is crazy when you think about it. It's like, what is the incentive here? And the irony of all ironies is, one, if you college people are so adamant that your way is chaste and pure and all that stuff, right, wouldn't you want those players gone, the one-and-done guys, the guys who are not here for an education and don't value an education, da-da-da, they're just coming to get ready for the next level? So if that's the case, why is Penny Hardaway calling the G-League tampering? Like, think about the term.
So I wrote about it, and my view on things might be out of step with the way a lot of people view it. I view the NCAA as a competing business that is sustained through the NBA owners' affiliation with their beloved alma mater, so they just keep it going. I don't think it's an economic consideration. I don't believe that the NCAA, for the most part, helps the NBA brand, and they have their games on during the NBA's games.
We've spoken about this in the past, yeah. And I disagree with you on this, on that one point. The one point where I think the NCAA is of massive value to the NBA is the idea of putting the bill on marketing for these players. Because the reality is, Jalen Green is going to go, he's going to learn, and it's going to be great for his development as a player and probably as a human being to go through this program. But the one thing where he's going to get hurt is, and I'm not talking about from his draft stock standpoint, but just in terms of overall marketability, because he didn't have that machine behind him.
I think that it can happen. I don't think it's necessarily always so. I don't think Kobe Bryant would have become a bigger star if he played.
What to do?
I don't think he would.
I don't know about that.
It's hard to be a bigger star than he was.
Let me put it this way. He would have been a bigger star in the first 3 years of his career.
Jerry West was
an all-star, an all-star starter in his second season.
Yeah, I think Jerry West would have had to find a more creative way to get him in the next year. But so it's a whole butterfly effect. Who knows?
Sure.
Yeah. Or LeBron. But I do think that Zion going in with the Duke bump got some.
LeBron was a case where no. Like, there are some people who just blow, like, everyone knew who LeBron was before he even declared for the draft. Yeah. Everyone knew who LeBron was before he played his senior year of high school. For
the cover of Sports Illustrated back when that was a huge deal. That was that's how I was introduced to him, was seeing him on that cover. That's how I learned about him.
And I would say there are a handful of high school players who are I'll give you Michael Beasley is one who probably didn't need to go to college. Mm. Michael Beasley was that big of a deal as a prospect. Michael Beasley is such a big deal that there are players who were either in his draft class or the year before him who said, oh, they look up to Michael Beasley. Like Kevin Durant, who was the draft class before Beasley, said, I used to look up to Michael Beasley.
I used to. Derrick Rose, probably another one.
Derrick Rose is another one. He could have done without. But
hype I would guys say, out of Chicago, you know,
the vast majority of big time blue chip one and done players, like they needed the bump. DeMarcus Cousins needed the bump. John Wall needed the bump. Zion needed the bump.
I don't know if the feelings are so warm for Kentucky that the bump really helps you that much.
It definitely helps. Anthony Davis needed the bump.
I don't know if Anthony Davis became – I mean, Anthony Davis was amazing, and I loved watching him during that Kentucky season. But then he goes off to some NBA outpost, and it's not like everybody's talking about him. Like Kemba Walker, nobody cared about Kemba Walker, Connecticut heroics
absolutely
when he was in Charlotte.
Look, Ethan, I'm not saying – that, go to college so that when you go to the shittiest NBA situation, you'll be on primetime every night. I'm saying whatever they're operating at, whatever the attention was at Kemba Walker at Charlotte, it would have been less had he not gone to UConn.
Okay, so I'm moving on. Okay, so that hot take is out there, but there's the other hot take that I got pushback on, and I wonder where you're at on that one. I think this could significantly hurt college basketball, and I hear the argument made. A lot of the argument made by a lot of the college basketball fans who were reading A was, I'm sick of one and done, get it out of here, which I understand. But the second one was, it doesn't matter, you're wrong. It will be just as popular without the big college prospect stars. You're wrong. It's all about tradition. It's all about tradition and people's connection to their school. Yeah, maybe for the hardcore fans. But you're not getting the viewership you'd get when you have a Zion Williamson. You're not getting that again. Like this is going to cause your sport to contract. I think the stars matter. The Trae Youngs, the Zion Williamsons, these matter as far as who's tuning in.
All right, so this is how I'm going to disagree with you on this. There's a couple of
ways. You're being creative. Deep down, you agree with me, and you're only disagreeing with me because you like disagreeing with me. God damn it.
No. I think things are going to be different for college basketball. And how they pivot is going to determine whether that different is status quo, whether that different is good, and whether that different is bad, right? There is – okay, so I saw this stat during the quarantine. They're talking about like – I want to say 80 to 90% of college football gate – I mean of college football revenue is from the gate, right? Despite the billions of dollars in TV deals, right? Still the majority of their budget is from the gate. Yeah. Where people come in spending concessions.
Those SEC stadiums are bigger than – I mean, yeah.
And paying for parking and all that stuff, right? So college in that way, in a very weird way, college is a sport that is driven on that tradition and stuff, one. But two, quality proof. What I mean by that is bad NBA basketball equals bad ratings. Nobody wants to watch that shit. Bad college basketball – I'm not saying they don't feel a dip, but the dip is considerably less than what a bad NBA product would be. And what I mean by that is if you take out all the star players from college basketball, all these one and dones, and now all you got is the guys who are going to be there at least 2 or 3 years, right? They're just not good enough. They're late bloomers or they're just not good enough overall. The numbers will be lower, but it won't be a massive dip. Because it's true. These people are going and yelling. It was like, oh, college basketball fans are great. No, they're not. They don't know shit about the game. They're just there to scream and get drunk. And it turns as it
to do
turns
that
out,
to do that like that sort of thing in the game. What is that?
It's how I show I'm young and I'm drunk, right? And so the idea is as long as the standard deviation from the median is the same, they won't notice. So in other words, as long as Duke and Kentucky are still like going to Final Fours and stuff, then Duke and Kentucky fans will not notice that these players are nowhere near as good.
Yeah, it's like you plebes don't know the difference between Larry Bird and Adam Morrison. We can just feed you anything.
And that's why I said it depends on how they react. Because if all of a sudden this means that Butler and Marist and William and Mary are way more competitive with the Dukes, the Carolinas, and the Kentuckys, then college basketball has a problem because people are like, wait, what do you mean? That's always because we don't have any of the top level talent. But if the top programs remain the top programs, no one is going to notice anything changed in a weird way. And then the last thing I will say about this, Ethan, is that at the end of the day, it's one program, one G League program, and they're going to take like 7 kids. There's still plenty of kids that are either not going to be good enough for the program basketball-wise or not going to be a fit from a personality or expectation-wise. They won't even be recruited.
You'll get your occasional Steph Curry. You'll get your
– Well, no, I don't even mean that. Like let's go back to Michael Beasley. Like they might have looked at the situation and said, yeah, you're not right for this program. You are by far one of the best players in this class, if not the best player. But your maturity levels, your expectations, this is for guys who know what the deal is. You need to be in a more like nurturing environment where they can literally baby you. Yeah. And so there are going to be guys like that who are going to be turned away and have to go to college.
It comes at a bad time for college basketball because of what you're saying. The duffel bag is shrinking.
Guys, I got to read here. If you are bored in the house, why not spend some time on yourself? It's like a Dr. Seuss riddle. Our sponsor today, Manscaped, is here to make sure you're well-groomed above and below the belt. Manscaped promotes clean hygiene when it comes to shaving, thanks to their Lawnmower 3.0, which I have and is great. Let me tell you something. I taught Kevin Arnovitz, the famous Kevin Arnovitz, to get into the trimming. He came back to me one day and he said, Jade, that was the greatest advice you've ever given me. He didn't really say that, but it went something like that. Manscaped is the only men's brand dedicated to below the waist grooming. Like, this thing is specifically built for below the waist. By the way, I was recommending trimming for Kevin above the waist. It was the arms. While you are probably looking for new things to do at home, why not make manscaping part of your routine? I do it once a week. Manscaped is forever changing the grooming game with their Perfect Package 3.0 precision engineered tools for your family jewels. The Perfect Package 3.0 kit comes with a new and improved lawnmower 3.0 waterproof cordless body trimmer. You can bring it right into the shower. And a ton of other liquid formulations to round out your manscaping routine. This third generation trimmer features a cutting edge ceramic blade to prevent manscaping accidents. Shaving is about to be nick free thanks to Manscaped's advanced skin safe technology. I mean, they have the best writer I've ever seen for a life. Inside the Perfect Package, you'll also find the Manscaped's crop preserver, an anti-chafing deodorant and moisturizer. Subscribe to the Perfect Package and get a new replacement blade refill for your lawnmower trimmer delivered to your door every 3 months, making sure your trimmers always stay fresh and clean. This is the Perfect Package for your Perfect Package. Do yourself a favor and always use the right tools for the job. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code THEATHLETIC at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code THEATHLETIC, all lowercase. And for a limited time, subscribers get not one, but two free gifts. The Shed Travel Bag, a $39 value, and the patented high-performance anti-chafing Manscaped Boxer Briefs. So go to manscaped.com. That's manscaped, manscaped.com today and use code THEATHLETIC. Back to you guys.
I do want to move on. I do want to talk about the thing everybody's talking about. I can't resist. It's fascinating. Amin, you staked out a position very early when it came to The Last Dance of excoriating hipsters for not fully embracing it and not fully praising it. Why? And do you feel validated in this particular endeavor?
Let me answer the second question first. That I absolutely feel validated, and I'll give you a great example. Episode 5 dealt with the Dream Team, right? And obviously, when they won the gold medal, one of the big stories was Michael Jordan draped himself with the flag to obscure the Reebok logo, because obviously Michael Jordan is a big Nike man, right? This is a story that not only was not unearthed by this documentary. In the moment, in 1992, I'm old enough to remember that big deal, right? Making a big deal. Michael covered the Reebok logo, et cetera, et cetera. So it was out then, and it's been talked about for years. And then Jack McCallum wrote a great book about the Dream Team, which I read, and he discusses it in there. And then they made a documentary based on that book, and they discussed it in there too. And so you're like, I mean, see, it's all stuff we already knew, except they had the footage of Michael Jordan in the car talking about, I got something for their ass tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I mean when I say, even when you think you know the story, watching this is going to illuminate and illustrate it in a way.
Allie, when he said that, Allie turned to me and she said, I didn't know Michael Jordan was such a shit stirrer. Like, she reacted to that. That was something that drew her in as somebody who doesn't care at all.
Absolutely. That's a great reason and a great quote by Allie. But what I'm trying to impress upon you, Ethan, is Amin, basketball expert, was blown away by that. Mm. That even the smartest among us who have read every basketball book and watched everything and know these people, it's different when you see it. Footage of it actually happening in that moment.
Oh, yeah.
That's the difference. That is the difference that if you read it in Jordan Rules or Dream Team, or it's not the same as seeing the motherfucking video of him saying it. And if you can't understand that, you're just too cool for that shit, as I told you after episode one of this thing, then go fucking watch a 30 for 30 on Dino Raja and be our Gordon Gonigerichek. Go learn some shit that nobody knows about someone nobody cares about. But this, you cannot deny the value of this documentary and some of the things that we're learning. And I'm not talking about the people who don't know any, because obviously massive value to the people who are learning this for the first time. But for those of us who already knew, There's stuff in there that we never saw, never heard, and now we're seeing and hearing.
Yeah. And there are things, there's just something to Jordan, his mystique, that is unique, that we just don't see elsewhere. That all the great things LeBron is and has done, maybe blame it on the era, but no, it's not even just that. He just doesn't have that. Like, whatever that is, he doesn't have it.
I'll tell you exactly what it is, Ethan. This one's easy, right? Mm. It's going to sound ridiculous, but it is a level, and it might be it is a veneer. It is absolutely a veneer. We're learning that through this documentary, but it is a veneer that he is unfazed by anything, Michael Jordan, right? And that absolutely is a function of the era we live in, because if Michael Jordan had Twitter and Instagram back then, and by the way, he said the same thing. I was at the Charlotte All-Star last year, and he was speaking at the tech summit, I want to say. And the quote was, they're saying, oh, these guys, talking to each other all the time. LeBron talking to each other all the time. And Michael Wilbon asked him, like, yo, how would you – like I said, there's no way Michael Jordan would have done that back in the day. And Michael Jordan was like, I'll be honest, man, like – I don't know, because I didn't have those capabilities. Like that for me, if I wanted to talk to Patrick Ewing, I had to, like, first of all, I had to pick up the phone, remember his phone number, call and hope he was at home. He might be on the road. He might be like, I don't know what time their game is. I don't know any of these things. I don't have any of this information available. And if he's on the road, I don't know what hotel they're staying at. I don't know what name he's left at the thing. So it's like I didn't do that. I wasn't calling Patrick Ewing every day, but a lot of that was just logistical, right? It's just like one day if our grandkids say, "What do you mean you didn't go to the moon on the weekend?"
Well,
like it would be weird for us to say, "Oh, these kids going to the moon every weekend." Da, da, da. I was like, "Yeah, we never went to the moon because that was not a reality for us. It was not a logistical reality for us to even pine for or whatever." And so in that regard, the veneer that Jordan had was easy to maintain because his ass wasn't on Instagram dancing and saying Taco Tuesday or on Twitter, like tweeting James 5454545, like, yo, actually, if you want to know, it was we ran the double clutch play. Like, he didn't
really
have
it. It was really Billy Donovan's fault, you know. Yeah. I mean, well, what was interesting about that? So, the juxtaposition, I kind of like how it jumps around with the timeline. I like how we're seeing in the Last Dance season and Jordan is getting asked the same question again and again and again and again and again about his retirement, and he's handling it impeccably. Boom, boom, boom. Every single city, boom, boom, boom. And you go, oh, your initial reaction, is this is early in the documentary, is, oh my God, Jordan could just handle himself in such a way that's way better than what the current athletes do, and it's not hard to juxtapose it against a Kevin Durant and how he handles it. But then later on, we're in 1992, 1993, and boy, does he look very, very Kevin Durant-y how he's handling the perils of fame. And you go, oh my God, he has made a journey to this place that we saw earlier, and we don't know what happens to get him there.
Let me just say this right now, and I'm going to send Jade this clip so he can put it in.
Ooh.
But I watched the entire interview with Ahmad Rashad, the one where he's wearing the sunglasses. Oh. And Jesus Christ, if he doesn't sound like a fiend. Listen to just this excerpt. Hold on.
If I ever had a problem, they never had a problem telling me that I had a problem. So they never came to me and said, hey, Michael, you got a gambling problem.
That sounds like someone who absolutely has multiple problems, right? Never had a problem, had a problem. And then, like, the idea, I was talking about this with my cousin the other day, right after the documentary, and he said, it's like, what about people who say that you're a gambling addict? Like, I'm not a gambleholic. If I was a gambleholic, would I have this watch on? Would I have these rings? My wife would leave me. My kids would starve. Like, the idea that the only way you can be a gamble, like, have a problem with gambling, be a gambleholic, addicted to gambling, is if your wife leaves you, your kids are starving, and you have to hawk it.
It's like, that hasn't happened yet. It's like the way you handle it if it's not a problem is to just go, yeah, this is silly. This is like, this isn't an issue. But the defensiveness and the shades and the shakiness of all that.
Ethan, one more thing to point out. The idea that he had a media blackout. He went 2 weeks without speaking to the media.
Yeah.
And that interview was his first. Like he said, I'll talk to me only if it's Ahmad Rashad, my best friend, which is a lot. It would be like if Kevin Durant ended his 2 weeks with saying, I'll only talk to Jay Williams, right? Which, Jay, if you're listening, man, you got screwed over because that should have been you.
You really should have broken that 2 weeks. That's true.
But the idea is that, like, you know, I felt bad. I mean, I knew that happened. I just forgot about it when I was killing Luka Doncic for not talking to the media after a loss. I said, look, man, if you're there for the roses, you better be there for the onions too. And like, that's part of being a superstar.
I have sympathy, but it's an interesting thing where it's really the paranoia of fame in a way where Jordan wasn't really right about what was happening, but within the maelstrom of fame, he felt like everyone was out to get him. Everyone wasn't out to get him. You know, yeah, you're going up against the Knicks. Their local media is taking shots at you. They want the Knicks to win the series. Mike Francesa is saying something bad about you in the New York Post, is saying you went to Atlantic City. I don't think the majority of America really cared what was going on with Michael Jordan and the gambling.
No, I mean, it led SportsCenter. It was a big deal. It was absolutely a big deal.
It was a big deal, but part of what's happening, I think, is this. Because you had the quote, Magic Johnson saying – was it DA who was saying Magic Johnson was saying that about how you media guys, you're going to drive him out of the sport. You're going to drive him out of this.
Yeah. DA said that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the thing that can't be admitted, it's not that they're saying such cruel things and such harsh things. It's that you're so invested in maintaining an image and you just don't have full control over it. And that's what makes you start going crazy. It's not that. I mean, the majority of what's being said about Michael Jordan overall is positive, but there's a pressure to how positive it is. And once any negativity starts to seep in, I think it just becomes a paranoid situation where you go, oh my God, I was controlling everything. Everything was good. And now it's all falling apart. And you start seeing him crack up in the way he was cracking up.
It's life, to borrow a term from you in your book, The Victory Machine. It's life inside the take zone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Like, he lived in the take zone since 84, right? So at that point, that's 9 straight years of living in the take zone, of which the last 4 or 5, right? Like starting in, because I like to point this out. And again, this is what I love about this documentary. It points out a lot of these things like, oh, LeBron gets criticized for everything, but Jordan was your hero. Like, no, there was times when they were talking about Jordan would never win. Jordan was not Magic and Bird. Jordan wasn't the Jordan. And it bothered him, obviously. But they all go through it. No one goes through this thing unscathed from beginning to end. I struggle to think of the NBA player who did not have to deal with this other than, like, if you go back far enough, like Cousy. By the way, me and Zach Harper discovered this Cousy guy. Jesus Christ. Ethan, you might have him beat. Do you know how many games, like, he'd have like 16 points, 11 assists on 2 of 20 shooting? I mean, like, it's not just it's a bad field goal percentage. It's like, pass the fucking rock. Why are you shooting 20 times?
I love this take that Bob Cousy was a ball hog.
Oh, he's like an unimaginable ball hog. Me and Harper, dude, he never shot 40% from the field in his career.
He just kept chucking.
Yeah, man. Like, yo, have some.
I love that. Like, Bob Cousy was the Russell Westbrook of his day as a take.
Have some humility. Yeah. Like, just, you know, pass the ball a little bit more. Like, just show some restraint out there.
Well, so what I find interesting about this, seeing it play out, seeing what fame does to people, I mean, this is something that I'm fascinated by, because it's my job. It's something I see in my job. It's something I observe, right? I understand the perspective of why are we even worried about these famous people? Other people go through more struggles. I get it. But
Winer, you got to go Winer. Why are we?
I get it, but I mean, it's almost like a fascinating psychological experiment that we just see up close. And I've now been around long enough where I've seen it again and again, and you just see what fame does to people. There is a loss of innocence, or maybe pretend innocence if you're a cynic, but you see it happen. Like, even Steph Curry, he's still a nice guy, but he's just got a bit of an edge that he didn't have at the very beginning. It makes you cynical.
Yeah, man, and Harden in this, man, look, I mean, and part of that is age, right? Like, we got to remember, we're meeting these young men at age 19, 20, 21, 22, and now they're 28 and 29. And I know from my perspective, I know when I started working in basketball, I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and full of piss and vinegar and, oh, you can't get me down, and this is great, and I'm living a dream, and da-da-da-da. And by the time I hit, like, I guess 30, 31 – right, working for the Suns, like, I've become jaded and cynical. And jaded and cynical in a way that now when people ask me, would you ever do it again? I always say, probably not, unless it was like the dream situation or a massive amount of money. Hmm. Right? Like there's no way you could have told me when I was 25, 26, hey, you'll be out, but you can get back in again and get right back to it. And you'll turn it down. I got like, no. I'm a lifer. Because they drum it in your head, like, the idea of being a lifer. You know, Alvin Gentry, this is my favorite stat of all time, probably. Alvin Gentry came to San Antonio from Kansas with Larry Brown in 1988. And since 1988, Alvin Gentry has been employed by an NBA team at least part of every single season. He has not had a single full season of unemployedness, or I'm going to do radio and TV or media stuff. He's been like, he got fired as a head coach, sat out the rest of the season. By the next beginning of next season, he was on another staff, either as an assistant or got another head coaching job. And so Alvin, when I was working with Alvin, I was like, Alvin's a goal, lifer. I'll always be working in this league. Preferably with Phoenix, like with Steve Kerr and David Griffin, and keep the band together and all that. But if it doesn't work out, I'll work somewhere. And by the end of my tenure, I was like, fuck this shit.
The NBA, I don't know if it's a show business thing, but behind the scenes, it's just not a very happy place. You know, it's got these moments. It's a hilarious place. You know, people make funny jokes. There are aspects of it that are obviously great. But yeah, it's a cynicism. And I think with fame in general, it just exposes you. You would think that the famous person would just be feeling great all the time because they're getting all the praise. But they're exposed to this because they become a commodity, and they're exposed to people trying to get a piece of the commodity. And that, I think, also makes them cynical. I mean, in my book, I talk about how I didn't know until I
was... This guy in my book. Okay.
My book that was written up by the New Yorker, by the way. Yeah. Yes. Hey, it's good. It makes my mom feel good. It's good times. Anyway.
It allows your mom to realize your work is valued. Oh,
I think my mother-in-law, by the way, just thought whatever I did was some make-believe thing and feared for her daughter until one day she was in a random restaurant and saw me on TV, and that just changed everything.
That's what did it? Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was until someone came up to her and like said, oh, my God, that's your son-in-law.
So anyway, I can't even remember what point I was trying to make because I got derailed on you.
You wrote your book.
Yeah. Walking around with Steve Kerr, where I didn't know that when you're famous and you walk around, people will foist a child onto you and say that the child wants a picture because they're using that as emotional blackmail for them to get a picture. And that's just part of being famous. That's just something that happens is weeping children being shoved towards you who don't want to be near you because they don't know who you are because daddy wants a picture and that's how he's using his child.
Has Steve ever told you the backfiring of that sort of situation for him?
Oh, what happened?
So Steve is walking to an airport. I believe this is when he's our general manager at the time. He's walking to an airport and a guy with a maybe 11 or 12 year old son says, hey, can you take a picture of my son? And Steve says, sure. and he puts his arm around the kid and, like, you know, adjusts himself, and then looks up and sees the horrified look on the father's face, who had the camera out or the phone out, said, "No, I want you to take a picture of me with my son."
Oh,
and she was like, and then at that moment he realized this dude had no idea who he was. He's just like, "Why is this stranger manhandling my child?"
Oh, I love that. I mean, that's innocent. He was probably relieved to see that. Did he explain that he was famous? He's like, "Oh, I didn't know because I'm actually a very famous person."
I think he said he tried to play it off as like, "Oh, hi, you know, and I'm just playing around. I'm just like a good friend." The other story that's like this is me and Steve Kerr were in Iowa watching a D-League game, and it's Iowa at the time played in the, like, an 18,000 seat arena. Like, it's a huge arena. So it was like Thomas and Mack before Summer League became an in thing, right? So you're like, you're sitting and you're like, there's a seat between us, and like, we're like two rows away from anybody, right? So the guy sitting two rows in front of us keeps turning around and sneaking a peek and like turning back, and like, he'll turn back and sneak a peek. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I mean, I'm like, okay, here it comes. You know, he's going to ask Steve for an autograph or something like that. And finally, the guy turns around, musters up the courage, and he looks at us and he's like, "Excuse me." And he looks at me and he said, "Do you used to play for the Bulls?" Not fucking kidding.
What did you say?
I said, "No, but he did." And it, clearly, he had no idea who Steve Kerr was. But I looked like someone who
played. What do you think happened? Like, his signals got crossed. Like, his brain associated Steve with the Bulls, but he was white, so this guy was stereotyping, and it just like ricocheted off of Steve and hit you. Like, what happened there?
I don't know. More importantly, like, for the rest of the trip, we tried to figure out who could I have possibly been mistaken for by him. And like, it was like, it's either BJ Armstrong, but I look nothing like him, Randy Brown, but I weigh like 200 pounds less,
Horace Grant, obviously. I mean, come on.
I think there was one more candidate. I can't remember who it was.
He like turns around. Were you Sam Smith's source?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I want to end on one thing, which is I can understand why Michael Jordan was paranoid about what people would think about him, but he's wrong. That's one point I'm ending on.
You mean the current Michael
Jordan? I'm saying the whole thing. The Michael Jordan of the past, who was freaked out about how the Jordan rules portrayed him, the Michael Jordan of right now, who was worried about whether we would hate him coming off of this documentary. I think the vicious side of him, it adds some texture. It reminds me of an American Hustle where they're talking about how, I think J-Law's talking about how every great perfume has a top coat of something quite nice and perfumey, but there's something rotten underneath it, like a little bit rotten, and that's what we're drawn to again and again and again. I think the vicious side of Jordan, the unpleasant side of Jordan, it adds to the legend in a way, and it makes it more compelling in a way that just all good guy veneer I don't think would.
I would agree. Like, I think we respect, like, again, as he's being described right now, it is a very unflattering description, right? Gamble-aholic, competition-aholic, whatever you want to call it, like bully, manipulative, et cetera, et cetera. These are all traits I think we can all agree are not positive traits, and yet we celebrate him even more for those, right? Yeah. And I think that's the big difference. As I acknowledged earlier, there are a lot of factors, like the environment we're growing up in makes it almost impossible to remain that air of mystery that he had, right? Given all that, the idea that Michael Jordan was angry, he would go out there and destroy you on the floor. When Kevin Durant's angry, he cries about it in a press conference, right? When LeBron's angry, he subtweets his teammates, right? That to me, I think that's part of why, no matter what he does, no matter how bad he looks here, it's still kind of like there's a rakish desperado charm to, like, yeah. And then he punched his teammate in the face. Yeah. What do you guys do? Pick up your phone and tweet about all in and all out. Like, there's something that we recognize and cherish in the same way that why are mobster movies so popular, right? Yeah. Why do people look at the Godfather and like, oh, Michael Corleone, what a great character. Like, yeah, he's a piece of shit. Like, watch this. Why do so many people, when I ask them, who's your favorite character on Power, they say Ghost. Well, Ghost is clearly the worst human being in the world, who's screwing over his own family, his kids, his wife, everything, his lover, no matter what, just to achieve whatever ends he is. Because we romanticize and put on a pedestal this idea of everyone since Al Capone, this country has an infatuation.
Billy with the Kid.
The guy who doesn't play by the rules, right?
Yeah, he makes his own rules. You know, I think that's a good one to end on. Another great conversation. I think insofar as we had point of contention, you might have won again. I know I always attribute it to my being generous, you know, and granting other people's points. But you know.
It's because I am far and away the best guest you ever have or you'll ever have.
Ooh. Wow.
Steve Kerr might be more famous and more accomplished, but he's not as good a guest as I am.
What about David? What if we got David? We want to get David Aldridge on soon. Are you putting yourself above DA?
As a guest, I'm not putting myself. Obviously, he's a Hall of Famer. I'm not David Aldridge, but as a guest on this podcast, I'm a better guest. I'm a better guest than anybody will ever have. Right?
Quarantine, you know, confidence. Why?
No, that's everyday confidence. You know why?
Why?
Because I played by my own rules.
Yes.
Rakish Desperado.
Well, to give a big thank you to Amin for stopping by. Huge thank you to Jade. Jade, who is just, I mean, the man has promoted my book to the degree where it's getting write-ups in the New Yorker. I think that is a credit to Jade. And to all of you listeners out there, we appreciate you listening. Buy the book. Leave a 5-star Amazon review. I will be very, very thankful.
Let me look up your review also right now on Amazon while you're on.
I mean, fine. Okay. Take care, everybody. Stay safe. See ya.
And a half stars on 47 reviews. 64% are 5-star, 19% are 4-star, and then you got 5% 3-star, 5% 2-star, and 7% 1-star. Ooh,
7% Kevin Berner.
Here we go. First one.
I don't need to hear any of this stuff. No, I tried to filter this stuff out. Ethan, no. I'm gonna hang up.
We're gonna laugh together.
Okay.
Well, you gotta listen to it. It's like Trump. It seems to be a book more about the author than the Warriors. A whole chapter on how Kevin treated him, really, and not a very interesting chapter either. That's the Trump part.
You know what? I do wonder if that's Kevin.
What a disappointment. Well, here's the funny thing. It's three reviews, 3 1-star reviews,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
This first one is by Tazzy Cat Amazon customer, right? The next review is by Strat Cat. The third review is by Koyogi 29. I couldn't even get through the sample first 27 pages. Obviously, the author is intelligent, but it felt like he just took a thesaurus and to think. Oh no, this guy's a real review here.
That's a real one. That's a real one. The others are Kevin Berners.
Oh, Strauss removes all of the joy from a team that was built on joy, making for a miserable slog of a book. If I might be honest, that is a refrain that I've heard. Yeah. Multiple times from people, like, when I pressed, they didn't like the book. Why not? And I'm like, no, and I'm telling them, this is the real, like, it's behind the scenes, it's very accurate and da 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 da. And finally, they always break and they say, it just made it seem so miserable.